Welcome to the Sphinx Thinks podcast. I'm Georgina Holmes, and we'll be progressing through time to uncover the mysterious world of life on Earth, from the emergence of life and evolution of us, to the first civilizations and innovations that got us where we are today. I hope you enjoy the show.
You know, we sometimes make the mistake of thinking about language as being speech, and we forget that, of course, language isn't about the way in which many of us produce it. It's a system of communicating we have as humans.
Today, I'll be discussing chimpanzee communication with Kat Hobater. When she's not travelling to the Budongo Forest Reserve in Uganda, you'll also find her lecturing at the University of St Andrews. Her work on primate communication is incredibly important in understanding our own species and our ancestors. But I'll let you hear all that for yourself in today's episode. So Kat, could you talk a bit about your research into great ape communication and the reason for studying chimpanzee gestures?
Yeah, definitely. So I think a lot of the reasons that we look at great apes, it's because obviously they're our closest relatives. One of the things that we often forget is we're also, for example, chimpanzees and bonobos share the majority of their DNA, over 98% probably with us. But we're also their closest relatives. So it's a really nice way to kind of have a think about what might have been going on in the evolution of our behavior by looking at it from both perspectives, and not just thinking about it from the human perspective, but also thinking about, you know, what does it mean to be a chimpanzee? What does it mean to be a gorilla? And trying to get into their minds a little bit. I think one of the lovely things about communication is if you understand what two individuals are talking about or communicating about, you get to understand all sorts of other aspects of what's going on in their life.
Yeah, actually, that's a really interesting way to think about it. So how do you go about interpreting what their gestures mean, understanding their communication, and perhaps differentiating a gesture from a movement?
Yeah, it ought to be the simplest part of what we do, right? How, like, what is a gesture? And it's actually probably the hardest thing to answer. So if I make an analogy with human language, especially if it's a language that's very unfamiliar to us in form. So I'm quite lucky. I grew up speaking a few different languages, but none of them were tonal languages. So East Asian languages like Thai or Vietnamese or Mandarin. And if I hear those languages now as an adult, even just parsing out which of these sounds go together to make one word and which of these sounds are two separate words can be really challenging. And we have exactly the same problem when we're studying non-human communication, in that I could look at a body movement like shaking my hand and a slightly different body movement like shaking my arm. And maybe that's all one gesture. Maybe shaking arms and hands in general means X. But actually, maybe it's two gestures, or maybe it's three or four gestures, depending on what your fingers are doing at the time. And trying to work out how to split and how to lump our body signals, whether it's movements of our body and gestures or the sounds that we're making when we're vocalizing, that's actually one of the trickiest things. And often it's this iterative process where we have a quick go, and then we look at the animal's behavior and we say, okay, do those signals seem to map onto particular behaviors? So are the animals, are the chimpanzees or the gorillas themselves treating that signal like it's the same, or are they treating these two signals like they're two different things? So what are their reactions to it? When do they use it? And then that helps us inform our coding system, and we go, okay, well, these two things are the same, we'll lump them and we try again. And we just go round and round on that process, sometimes for years or even decades, before we get a good idea of what the system looks like itself.
I like the idea of being able to look at what follows a gesture and how apes respond to it in order to understand it. I think that's really clever. So how does communication vary between different great ape species and even different groups/regions of the same species?
So one of the hardest things is that if we're talking about different great ape species, almost none of them live in the same places in the wild. So chimpanzees and bonobos don't live in the same places. There are a very few places where chimpanzees and gorillas live in the same place. Obviously, humans now today share those environments with all of those different ape species. But it's very difficult for, it's not as if we could say, okay, we understand chimpanzee, we understand gorilla, there's a lot in common, could a chimpanzee understand a gorilla? Because we don't have anything that we can go and look at. But we can at least say what are the similarities between the different systems. And it's pretty striking, especially in the African apes. So chimps, gorillas, bonobos, and humans are all African great apes. We also have orangutans, and then you get into the small apes like the gibbons. And each time you're getting a little bit further back down the evolutionary tree to the point where we all last had a common ancestor. Mm-hmm. So if we're talking 5 or 6 million years ago, then humans, bonobos, and chimps had a last common ancestor in common. And we've obviously changed quite a lot in the last 5 or 6 million years, but so have they. So what we have to do is look at their behavior today and our behavior today, or the behavior of chimps and bonobos today, and see what they have in common. And chimpanzees and bonobos, as you might expect, have a lot in common. So their gestures, they use about 80 different gesture types, but about 90% of them are the same. So each of the any chimp or any bonobo could use one of any of these 80 gestures, but if you look at them, then about 90% of them are going to be the same. About 80% of the chimp bonobo gestures are the same in the gorillas. And then we've been desperately trying to work out how we look at human communication to see what we would compare, because we have language. Now, we also move our bodies, right? And we kind of, you know, we wave our hands around when we talk. But it's not quite the same, because the meaning that we're communicating goes into our language rather than into our hand movements a lot of the time. So it's taken us a really long time to get anything like a sort of human repertoire of gestures we could compare. But we've started to be able to try and answer that by looking at some very young children who don't have much vocabulary in their language yet. Yeah. Which is a really fun way to do it. I don't know if you've ever, if you've got younger family members or friends and kind of tried to do, kids use gestures all the time because of course they can add that in.
It makes sense studying younger children as well, because I know some people do that to look at the way they've learned to stand and walk and things like that. So
yeah, there's this idea that sort of recapturing evolutionary time within developmental time. So can we see how you change from being something that goes on all fours to something that's bipedal, or something that goes from gestural communication to something that goes to vocal communication, which are questions that we have about our evolutionary trajectory over millions of years, but that also happen to us as individuals going from birth to maturity. So there are ways to try and ask the same sort of question, but by coming at it from different perspectives.
So on that, what has studying chimpanzees taught you in general and about perhaps the evolution of language?
So one of the things that I think is really impressive is how big a repertoire. So we're talking probably at least about 80 different types of gestures that these apes can use to communicate with. So this is a really big repertoire and a really flexible one, and they're using it all the time. It doesn't matter if you are a 6-month-old baby or the 60-year-old grandpa of the whole community, then you're going to be using these gestures. So it's really important to them. And I think also learning that it's a very potentially powerful system of communication. You know, we sometimes make the mistake of thinking about language as being speech, and we forget that, of course, language isn't about the way in which many of us produce it. It's a system of communicating we have as humans, and that means sign languages are full languages. It's just a different modality of expressing them, but it's language, written language. And so we can actually think about looking for some of these language-like capacities in other species. Outside, we don't have to be tied to their vocalizations. I think for an awfully long time, we sort of made this mistake of focusing straight in on other animal species vocalizations. And we sort of overlooked that actually a lot of the other signals they do, and in this case, gesture, probably has more in common with language than some of their vocalizations do. So it's good to keep an open mind.
Definitely. I think we do forget that language is more than just our vocalizations. But on that, I am going to ask, what, if anything, have you seen which maybe could suggest a transition to vocal language, or is there any evidence of perhaps changes in facial shapes?
That's the million-dollar question. If I had a good answer to that, then we probably I probably have a lot less work to do for the next 10 years. But it's really tricky to know why. So clearly there is, I mean, one way around it, which is a bit of a cheap way of saying it, is that language itself is what we'd call multimodal. It's not just the words that come out of your mouth, but it's everything. So your body language, your facial expressions, you know I'm joking or being sarcastic rather than cruel, not because of the words I use, but maybe the tone or the fact that I smile when doing it or something like that. So everything goes into one pot. So in some ways it's a bit, some people would argue that it's a bit of a sort of waste of our time to try and make these kind of like, to separate everything out when everything we do comes at the same time. So even if we were chatting on the phone and we couldn't see each other, I would be waving my hands, right? It's pretty much impossible to suppress these elements of communication. But there's still something important that must have shifted, because the way in which apes are using their vocalizations, some of them look a little bit like language, but many of them seem to be more about expressing emotion. And the way in which they're using their gestures seem to be about asking for something. And typically we would think of it being the other way around. So in speech or in sign, we would do the asking for things. And when we're moving our faces or moving our bodies, it's adding kind of emotion or emphasis. And nobody really knows what caused that switch. There are sort of all sorts of hypotheses about maybe it was tool use and we needed to use our hands more often. Maybe using vocal and verbal communication lets you communicate more easily to lots of individuals, or perhaps it's more abstract and it's easier to come up with ways of describing things that are outside the room or in the future or the past. But I'm never very sure about those explanations either, because we can do all of that with sign language. So there's absolutely no reason at all that you need spoken speech and spoken language to do it. So that's very definitely work to be done type question, I think.
So if we just go back to gestures and studying them, are there any common or prominent gestures you tend to see chimpanzees using?
Lots. I mean, they gesture a lot. So they're gesturing all the time every day to ask for pretty much anything that goes on in their day-to-day life. So come here, get lost, give me that, all of the kind of usual suspects. Grooming is something that's really important for chimpanzees, not just to keep clean, but it's also a way of building and bonding with each other. So building social relationships. So if you groom with another chimpanzee, you get the same sort of oxytocin response that we see when you interact with a friend, like sharing food, or when we interact with our friends, we get this kind of oxytocin response, and chimps get it when they're grooming. So we know it's about more than just cleaning all the little kind of insects off each other, and it is this bonding thing. So they spend a lot of time doing it, and there are therefore some gestures that get used a lot of the time, and that's usually groom me, can I groom you, or could you groom me here instead? It's very rarely, I don't think I've ever seen them say stop grooming me, but potentially yeah. I suppose it's possible.
And are there any gestures where your interpretation and meaning of them has changed since you've been able to study them more?
Yeah, that's why it's one of the tricky things about gesture, is that a lot of animal signals are what we call very fixed. So, for example, an alarm call in monkeys might mean aerial predator like eagle or ground predator like leopard. But it's not very ambiguous. It's not going to have two meanings, because you don't want it a bit like, you know, if you stand there shouting fire in a theater, you want everyone to understand exactly what you mean. You don't want everyone going, wait a second, which version of fire does she mean? So a lot of animal signals are really fixed in their meaning, but gestures, a bit like human language, are quite flexible. So the words we use can have two or three different meanings, and the gestures can too. So that means sometimes we think we've got a handle on something because we see it used really often, but it might occasionally be used in another context that's a bit rare and we haven't seen it before. And we start then to get this idea of, okay, well, maybe it's got different meanings. So leaf clipping. So basically chimps will take leaves off a tree pop them in their mouth and they make this little tearing noise. And in the communities I work with, that's usually their sort of version of a pickup line. That's how they get the girl, saying, you know, I'm interested, do you want to come kind of away with me? But there are also some communities who use it before they drum or even to ask for play. And in the group where I worked, everybody had said, okay, it's only used for solicitation. But very quickly, once I started looking at it in lots of detail, we also started to see occasional uses in play or occasional uses before drumming. And I think a lot of the time as scientists, you'd think that if you study something for an awful long time, you spent a lot of time with an animal, that you kind of understand them well. But sometimes until you think about an idea, you don't notice things when you're with them. So even people that were with them and knew these chimps for decades just hadn't noticed that this little signal was also used sometimes to ask for play as well.
Has your research come to develop in any other aspects since you've been able to study them further then?
It was entirely accidental that I started studying great ape gestures. I always loved there's all these scientists out there who had this very kind of clear idea and they pursued it. But I started working on an entirely different project that didn't work out. And then my mentor and for a long time supervisor at St. Andrews had studied gesture in captive groups of apes. So it was recognized that gesture was important for them and that it was something that shared some of these key properties with language. But one of the things that happens when you study captive apes is you end up getting an awful lot of your data from play, because captive apes have it pretty good. They live in social groups with all the food they can get. They don't have to go running around the large rainforest trying to find it or fight off the neighbors or do any of the other things like escape predators. And so they spend an awful lot of spare time playing with each other. And I think that gave us this impression that gesture was very interesting, but mostly to do with play. It happened all the time, but it was, and the minute we started looking at it in the wild, and that was basically my job. We knew apes gestured in the wild, but we weren't even really sure if a lot of the gestures we were seeing in these captive apes had been picked up either from humans or from living in these very human-like environments. Mm. You know, you just can't compare, even in a wonderful zoo with lots of space and social interactions, it's not going to compare to living in a rainforest with kilometres of forest and all of the other things that kind of go on in there. And what we learned very quickly when we were looking at wild apes was how important gesture is to so many aspects of their life. And so that's what we really started out trying to do, is just describe this very important system. What are the gestures? What are they used for? But I think where we're also headed now is this idea that now we have, after about 50 years or so, a good handle on what the gestures are and what they mean. We can use our understanding of gesture as a tool to now ask questions about what's going on in their minds. So it's almost as if understanding their communication gives us this little key that we can unlock a whole suite, a whole sort of room full of other questions that we get to ask about, how do they see different relationships with each other? And do they recognize rank? Do they know who they're related to? Do they know what somebody else knows? So do they remember that their friend was at the feeding tree yesterday, and so I don't really need to tell him that there's a feeding tree up ahead, but your sister kind of was somewhere else, and so maybe it would be nice to inform her of it. And being able to understand what they're communicating about between each other tells us lots and lots about everything else going on in their lives.
There's two points I'd like to pick up on from that. As you're studying chimpanzees in the wild, what are the advantages of studying animal behaviour in the wild as opposed to in captivity? And also, where do you see this research going in the future?
So I think an awful lot of primatologists, we end up in this sort of trap of either thinking that wild is better, somehow more natural, or captive is better because you can do lots of things. I think, honestly, we can just ask very different questions in those two different situations. And it is because, I mean, if I think about the chimpanzees in particular that I work with. So the Sonso community and the Wibera community, who I know best, they're two groups of chimps who live out in Uganda, up on the border with DRC. And Wibera has probably 120 individuals in it. In Sonso, the oldest individual is over 65 years old. I mean, what she's seen in her lifetime kind of blows my mind a little bit. And they will fight with the neighbors. They need to find food to survive. Their relationships really matter. And they also, all of our behaviors are in some way adapted to the environment that we evolved in. You know, they help us get by. So evolution is a pretty kind of strict taskmaster. There's not a lot of scope for things that waste energy and waste time. And so if we have a behavior, it tends to be something that was useful for us as a species. Now, obviously, as humans, we've dramatically changed our environment in a very short amount of time, so evolution hasn't really sort of necessarily caught up with that. But what we can ask of wild chimpanzees are these questions about how is communication adapted to the environment, because that's the environment they've lived in for hundreds of thousands of years. In captivity, on the flip side to that, you can do all sorts of other things that you just can never do in the wild. So in the wild, even with the best of intentions, I don't have perfect information. I don't know exactly where they've been or what they've been up to at all times every day. They might have bumped into somebody else and found out a bit of information I didn't know that they knew. Or maybe there was a big fight with the neighbors yesterday and I wasn't with them that day or something like that. In a zoo or a captive situation, you've got the opportunity to have almost perfect control. You know, hopefully you know exactly where they are all the time, because if you don't, you're in trouble for a different reason. But you can also present them with all kinds of, you know, you can change their environment in one little way and see how that change affects their behavior. And then you can put that back and change it in a different way. So we just get to ask very different questions in those two places. But I love field work, and that means that both the questions I'm interested in, which are the evolutionary ones, and the work that I want to do, lends itself to being in the field in the rainforest. Now, wait, there was a part two to that question.
Yeah.
What was it? Remind me.
Where do you think research could go in the
field? Oh, where is it going to go? Let me get my crystal ball out. I mean, I think one of the things that I'm really interested in looking at the moment is the idea of culture in communication. Great apes were one of the first non-human species that we were able to say had cultures. So people like Jane Goodall looking at their tool use, and now many decades of research is showing that you learn how to do something because others around you do it, not just because it makes sense to do it in that environment. So my chimps in Bodongo don't use stone tools, but there are no stones in Bodongo and there are no nuts to crack in Bodongo, so it makes a lot of sense that they don't. But also they don't use stick tools, and there are plenty of sticks and plenty of things you could eat with a stick. And so it doesn't really make sense if it's not a cultural difference. But a lot of what we've looked at in terms of culture is what we call material culture, so tool use, physical things in your life. Largely because that's the easiest thing to see and record, because it leaves, you know, when you finish using a tool, you leave it behind and a researcher can come along and pick it up and measure it. But we haven't really looked at culture in communication. And if we think about humans, and I was to say, you know, if you think about something that is from your culture, what sort of things would come to mind?
Well, it's what we celebrate. It's the food we eat. It's how we live, really. And I guess our language and accent comes into that too.
Or like the clothes we wear, right, and that kind of stuff. It's all the fashions and the kind of fads and things we have. And most of those things on that list don't leave much of a trace behind, right? So many of the things we think about in these lists of what we think of as iconic human culture isn't tool use. It's not leaving a physical trace behind. It's things that sort of disappear with them. And so now that we understand gestural communication better in a few groups, what I'm hoping to do is basically use the same methods in lots of different groups and see whether or not there is accent and dialect and language kind of equivalence in that way in the gestures as well.
Brilliant. So I'm going to conclude with asking you if you have any advice you could give to somebody who's listening, who's decided that they actually want to go and study primates and understand behaviour.
It really helps to get some experience of watching other species. Now, that does not have to be primates. You can get really good experience sat in your garden or going for a walk somewhere. And just instead of looking at something and walking past it, just sit and watch them for a while. The majority of my life is sat down watching things, waiting for things to happen. And it is a terrifying amount of my time and life has been spent doing that. But it will tell you two things. One, it will, I think, start to tell you about how behaviours and the environment and different things all interconnect a little bit. So, you know, okay, I saw this thing happened. What happens next? Why might it have happened? If I walk down this path in a week's time, is the same thing going to happen? Am I going to see the same individuals? And I think just starting to think about the world around us in those terms and getting to watch it is a fantastic place to start. You do not need to be working with primates to understand how to look at behaviour. You can also just watch us, you know, be a people watcher too. I mean, we are primates and we exhibit many of the same behaviours. So there's a lot to be learned, I think, there too.
Well, thank you so much for taking the time to talk to me. And we've covered some really relevant topics. I hope anyone who's listening has maybe been inspired and wants to go away and look at primatology and primates. If so, please subscribe and leave a rating. And if you have any questions or queries or suggestions for future episodes, I'm at the Sphinx Thinks on Instagram, Sphinx_thinks on Twitter. And you can find me on my website, www.sphinxthinks.com. I hope you enjoyed the episode. And next week, I'll be discussing bioarchaeology with Dr. Rebecca Gowland. See you then.